We all know the nutrients we eat affect our physical health, but what about our mental health? Today, the connection between food, the gut, and our brains. Plus, we're wrapping up our series of summer book recommendations with some of our favorites for kids and young adults, and fewer students are learning cursive in elementary and middle school. Some educators worry this could spell trouble for preserving the billions of handwritten documents in our national archives.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, we wrap up our summer reading recommendations with books for our youngest listeners. Everything from picture books to books for high schoolers. Also, speaking of high school, we'll talk about how the loss of teaching cursive might affect our understanding of historical artifacts. But first, a lot of us have experienced having a gut feeling about something. And it turns out the microbes in our gut and other parts of our body may indeed affect our mood and sense of well-being in ways we're just beginning to understand. A study from the U of I published last month found there was an association between diet, gut bacteria, and symptoms of anxiety and depression. Hannah Holscher co-authored that study. She's a professor of nutrition in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at the University of Illinois. She joins us in studio to tell us more about this microbiome research. Also joining us is Dr. Trupti Gokhani. She's a board-certified neurologist, but also has training in Ayurvedic medicine, which she's incorporated into her practice helping patients at the Zera Mind and Body Clinic in Glenview, Illinois. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Dr. Gokhani, I wonder if I can start with you. Your medical training is in neurology, and I wonder if you can explain to our listeners our gut and brain and how they're connected.
Sure. You know, it's really interesting because most of us in the field of neurology focus on the brain that is sitting within our heads, and we forget that there's a second brain, the enteric nervous system, that's actually residing within our gut. And they are very directly linked. It's taken years to appreciate the importance of the gut-brain connection. And one of the most important ways they're linked is by the nerve called the vagus nerve, which directly links the enteric nervous system, which is the nervous system within the gut, to the brain, the central nervous system, the brain that's within our head. And what's fascinating is that there's this communication that happens between the gut and the brain that most of us really don't respect as much as we should.
I think a lot of people, Dr. Gokhani, might not even realize that we have two complete nervous systems within our body, right?
Correct.
So, Professor Holscher, you recently co-authored a study that was about not even our gut, but the microbes within our gut and people's feelings of anxiety and depression. Before we even get to that, I wonder what we know about our gut bacteria, because I think people oftentimes hear this term of microbiome. Can you just explain what that is for people who maybe have heard kind of that being thrown around, or a lot of people are talking about our gut bacteria and how important that is these days?
So the microbiome is defined as a collection of microbes that reside within an environment. So we are interested in the bacteria that are present within the gut, and they're present in impressive numbers. There's about as many bacterial cells as human cells within the body, just within the gut. What's been happening is over the last handful of years, the technology has really increased our ability to be able to study those microbes and know what microbes are there and what ways can they interact with our foods that we eat. So my lab is interested in the microbiome because when we consume foods that contain dietary fiber, like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and legumes, those contain food components, so dietary fiber, that our own human enzymes can't break down. So instead, all of these microbes that reside within the gastrointestinal tract have the ability to break down those fibers. And they'll produce byproducts like short-chain fatty acids, which at least in animal research are thought to be able to help signal along the gut-brain axis. So some of the research that my group has done is trying to better understand this connection between diet, the microbiome, and health. And so this would be cognitive health and thinking about mood. But, you know, we're still have a long way to go.
And what does your research show when we're particularly thinking about the food that we consume and how that relates to mental health issues like anxiety or depression?
Yeah, so the study that you alluded to is a cross-sectional study. So we can't determine cause and effect. And so what this study did was we were interested in following up on research that had been conducted in animals. So a lot of the research on the gut-brain axis and the microbiome, especially in that connection, has been done in animals. And so rodents especially have different physiology than humans do. And so the way that their bodies interact with the food that they consume is a little different than how our own human digestive enzymes would interact with that food. And so an important step that my group is interested in doing is, are these studies that were found in animals, you know, do we see the same relationships when we study humans? So this was just a smaller cohort. There were only about 130 people in the study. And so again, we were just looking at them at one time point, and they had done questionnaires to assess symptoms of depression, anxiety, and stress. And we also had diet questionnaires. So we were categorizing what types of foods were they eating? And we were able to quantify how much fiber was in their diet. Because again, that fiber is going to provide a substrate for microbes to use as energy and then can produce those metabolites like short-chain fatty acids, which may be signaling along the gut-brain axis.
That's Professor Hannah Holscher, who teaches in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at the University of Illinois. Dr. Trupti Gokhani is also with us. And Dr. Gokhani, I think probably we've all kind of grown up hearing why you should eat your vegetables, right? Our parents told us this. Our grandparents told us this. I wonder what you think about what the medical research shows, the scientific research shows. Professor Holscher was just talking about this one particular study that they've been working on. What do we know so far about scientific research when it comes to the food that we eat and how that could affect our mood?
Yeah, this is such an important area because the research in this area is exploding. We're now seeing that diseases such as Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, there's a lot of studies now looking at the microbiome, looking at gut health, and it's linked to potentially its role in creating disease if the gut is imbalanced, to potentially even improving disease if we can actually improve the microbiome and the gut health. And the beauty of Ayurveda, which is something that I'm really passionate about, is this ancient literature, which is 5,000 years in origin, tells us that the gut is the origin of disease and that if we can understand it, we can truly shift the way that disease occurs and maybe even prevent or reverse certain conditions. And so there's so much research right now looking at the health of the microbiome and the presentation of individuals with disease. There's a recent study looking at Parkinson's disease, looking at those with Parkinson's had a higher risk of constipation, and that if we start screening earlier and looking at this in individuals before they develop Parkinson's symptoms, we could actually potentially shift the onset of disease and maybe even prevent some of these neurodegenerative diseases from occurring, which I think is so fantastic because we have an opportunity to learn and shift.
So, Dr. Gokhani, as you said, you've been trained in both traditional Western medicine, but you also practice Ayurvedic medicine. I wonder if there are people who might maybe view this. I know your words you've used in the past is people might think this is a little like woo-woo. What do you think about the history of what? It's very interesting to me that you're contrasting current research that's happening with Ayurvedic medicine, which you're saying is centuries old, but maybe has wisdom that is obviously still important today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Ayurveda, the reason I stumbled across it was because I myself was struggling with insomnia when I was in medical school, and I was looking for tools to help myself. And what I found was this really, you know, fascinating literature in Ayurveda. And Ayurveda actually means wisdom of life, wisdom of healing. It's 5,000 years old, and the reason it's still around is because it's a system that actually is still applicable and can be applicable to modern medicine in that it looks at us as unique kind of mind-body types, and we have a unique nature to us and even a unique gut type to us. And if we can understand ourselves, understand our gut type, we can actually understand how to use food and even how to choose the right career or choose the right partner in our lives to balance our systems. And so what's interesting about Ayurveda is even though it's ancient and seems a little bit like woo-woo, like people would think, the principles such as the gut is the origin of disease, we're now seeing modern research prove these ancient principles. We're seeing things that we thought were really not that important in terms of well-being and health be crucial to helping people with conditions that they're struggling with where medicines can't help.
Like what, Dr. Gokhani, when you're saying, like, what kind of things do you think we're seeing, that things we thought were not important?
Yeah. So, for example, you know, getting to bed at 10 p.m., one of these principles that's an Ayurvedic principle of having a set bedtime routine. 10 p.m., between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., is the time that the liver cleanses. It's a time that's really important to get into your deep sleep, because when your brain is now in its restorative mode, your body can heal. The body can actually cleanse toxins. The toxins that have built up because foods haven't been broken down appropriately, the liver hasn't had time maybe to cleanse during the day, the liver can do its work in the evening, and especially at bedtime when you're sleeping. And now we're actually showing, and there's studies now proving that between 10 p.m. and onwards, you release growth hormone, which is a sign of hypothalamus kind of releasing hormones that are needed to reset the circadian pattern for the next day. And there's actually medical now research proving the importance of a 10 p.m. bedtime, not only for growth hormone release, but for also weight loss. And so we're now seeing the medical data support the ancient wisdom, such as you should go to bed at 10 o'clock. And before that was when I would present this, you know, at my neurology meetings and with my colleagues, they'd say, oh, that sounds interesting, but where's the data? Well, now we have data proving why 10 p.m. is important.
So thanks for that, Dr. Gokhani. When we're thinking about our gut, I wonder, Professor Holscher, when it comes to our gut, what do we know right now about when we're thinking particular about the role that gut bacteria plays? As we're thinking about, you said that you started this conversation by saying there's a lot that we don't know yet.
Yeah, I think especially when we consider the gut microbiome in human health, a lot of it is just at the level of correlation. So we see associations. In our study, for example, we reported that individuals that had higher bifidobacteria or lactobacillus reported lower symptoms related to anxiety or depression. But again, these are just
people who had higher levels of this bacteria reported lower. And these are bacteria that's in your gut?
In your gut, yes. So,
and where would you get that? Like, I think lactobacillus, is that a yogurt, right?
So when we're doing the human clinical trials, you know, the stool sample is our surrogate marker of the gut microbiome. So those microbes are going to come from sources, different sources throughout our lifespan. So the initial seeding of the gut is primarily occurring during the birthing process. So you'll be seeded with some of those microbes from the vaginal canal, or if you were born by cesarean section, maybe more initial inoculation with the hands, or, you know, thinking about saliva from kissing the babies, the environment. And then the baby's first food will have a large impact on seeding that those microbes as well. So breast milk is a live fluid. It's full of different types of microbes that are help support the baby's health and their gut development. So those microbes can come in through there as well. And then certainly in our diet, as you alluded to, there are microbes in fermented foods like kimchi or yogurt or sauerkraut, especially if you're finding it, you know, in the refrigerated section rather than sitting on the shelf. So, but even soil contains microbes.
Dr. Gokhani, I wonder what you see with your practice when it comes to thinking about your patient population in terms of their food and mood.
90% of the serotonin is made in the gut. And serotonin is our happy chemical. It's a neurotransmitter that helps with our mood, helps balance up depression and reduce anxiety. So there's such a direct link between eating foods that support the microbiome and creating neurotransmitters. And so we have different opportunities to help nourish the gut in order to create the neurotransmitters, in order to signal that vagus nerve I was mentioning earlier, to chat with the brain to say, hey, are we doing all right? Are we healthy and happy? Or are we not feeling good? And the gut will signal to the brain in that way.
We're almost out of time, but Dr. Gokhani, I just wanted to end by asking you and Professor Holscher, you as well. But Dr. Gokhani, as people who are listening to this, they might think, how should we be thinking about the food that we consume if we think there might be some connection to our mood? And certainly, we know that the food we consume is a big part of determining our microbiome and our gut bacteria.
I think the first step is to realize that food itself is powerful. Food has so much power within it to really heal our minds and our bodies, and to look at food and to realize that, you know, our physical bodies, I like to think of it this way, our physical body is basically our food rearranged. And so if you think about your plate of food, what is on that plate, and whatever you eat is really going to be translated into your physical body. Really try to use, as was mentioned earlier, whole foods, whole grains, you know, food that comes from planet Earth and not processed and chemically modified. And if we can start with that and then start to really think about, can we now add prebiotic foods and probiotics into our diet, we can truly support the gut in a way that it can actually nourish the rest of our body and then support our immune system and brain health and give us the longevity that we're all looking for.
Professor Holscher, for folks who are not studying this like you or Dr. Gokhani, who are dealing with this in a medical setting, how should we be thinking about this?
Eating the rainbow, aiming for, you know, more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, legumes, and fermented foods like yogurt are going to help support health. And I would just encourage you to continue to have a little bit of an air of caution. If something sounds like it's too good to be true, we may not be quite there yet. So the gut-brain axis is a really exciting area of research. And hopefully in all of our lifetimes, we'll be able to stand up on a pedestal and say with 100% accuracy that, you know, eating this food is going to change this microbe and help make you happier. But we aren't quite there yet, at least in humans. So it's an exciting area. So when you're thinking about, you know, again, supporting gut health, eat the rainbow, try to find some foods that you enjoy. Trying to have as many different types of fruits and vegetables and those different mixes in there will support the metabolism of lots of different types of microbes and just provide some balance in your life.
Professor Hannah Holscher teaches at the University of Illinois. Dr. Gokhani has a Zira Mind and Body Clinic in Glenview. Both of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. When's the last time you saw someone write in cursive? Maybe your grandmother still uses cursive in your birthday card. Perhaps you see it scrawled on the back of old family photos. Maybe I'm an anomaly because I write in cursive all the time, but using cursive on an everyday basis has become a thing of the past for many people. Throughout Illinois, fewer students are actually even being taught cursive in elementary and middle school. And with cursive on the way out, some historians and educators are worried about who will be left to read the billions of handwritten historical documents in the National Archives. Sarah Jahant is an 8th grade social studies teacher at Northbrook Middle School in Mendota. That's about an hour south of Rockford. Also on the line from Washington, D.C. is Chandra Manning, a history professor at Georgetown University. Sarah, Chandra, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for the chance to be here. It's nice to talk to you. Yep, thank you.
Sarah, so you're a middle school social studies teacher. I wonder if you can say, do your students grow up learning cursive?
I will say that it's, for my district at least, it's been very hit or miss. I know some of the more traditional teachers have really stuck to it, and those students that come through my class, because I have the full 8th grade roster, the students that had those teachers in their earlier years, some of them have stuck with it, and then I have other students that didn't have any formal instruction. We haven't really been consistent in the past, at least, and so they don't have a lot of exposure to cursive. So by the 8th grade level, the majority, hands down, have dismissed or left cursive behind.
So, Sarah, that means they can't read cursive. It's not just, I think we think about writing cursive, but then that means they can't read it as well.
Exactly. And, I mean, and that has a lot of practical, I guess, issues even just day to day, because I've been teaching, this is going to be my 20th year. And so I grew up, I was trained and practiced with cursive. You know, you had mentioned in the intro about, you know, grandparents' birthday cards and cursive. So I've had plenty of exposure, but my handwriting now has sort of evolved into a hybrid of print and cursive. And so when I have notes on the board or I've written something, I'll often have students, they'll pause and they'll go, what does that say? My own handwriting has changed, and how my students sometimes struggle when I incorporate cursive into it, and then I fall back out of it, and then I go back into print because it's so much easier for them. Rather than challenge them, I fall back and I go back to that print because I know that they can read that and understand the content.
Chandra Manning is also with us, a history professor at Georgetown. Chandra, is this also true for your college students?
I think so. I think that there's some who still have cursive, but that number is definitely shrinking. And for a history teacher who relies a lot on immersing my students in primary sources, it's definitely something I notice much more now than in years past. And there's still some, but the numbers seem lower and lower every year.
And I know you recently taught, in the past, you've taught a 3-hour seminar at Georgetown on Abraham Lincoln, where you look at a variety of different documents and letters that he wrote. Do you find that your students are actually able to read this then and understand these letters?
Well, we needed 3 hours to do it. The Library of Congress currently has a crowdsourcing project, a number of them, in which it asks people sort of around the country to transcribe documents that they have digitized scans of from their collection. You go to the web and you see the picture, the scan of the handwritten document, and then you can type up a transcription so that in future years, people who can't read cursive can read the document. So it's a large crowdsourcing project that I decided to involve my class in, not at first thinking about the cursive aspect at all, but rather thinking about two things. And one was the benefit of real-time, here's what historians do together as a group instead of sending them off to do their thing, all of us working through challenges together. That was one of the draws. The other draw was whatever we did together would then be available, be part of the Library of Congress website. It would make a mark. It would be something that students in our class did that would be available for people to have access to in future. And I think, underestimated the barrier that cursive would form, because Abraham Lincoln himself had actually quite legible handwriting, but we were transcribing letters to Lincoln. And so there were some beautiful 19th century copperplate cursive hands, and then there were some not so beautiful copperhead or cursive hands. So the cursive itself did turn into one of the things we had to talk about in that seminar.
And I know, were your students, I know you mentioned a frustration threshold. Is that basically just, it's almost like learning another language, right? Teaching students how to read cursive, it sounds like.
Well, right. And these are students who have come up through an education system where stuff has pretty much been available to them in print. You can go on the web, and any number of websites today will just sort of produce a document for you. And there it is. And it's on the lesson about the causes of the Civil War, you know that it's going to be easy to read, and it's going to be about the causes of the Civil War, and it will be immediately relevant. And the sort of hunt and gather and hit and miss aspect of what it is to do history is sort of removed from the equation to focus on other things. So first of all, students had to get used to the notion of a little bit less of a prepackaged entrance into a historical document. They just walked into whatever document needed transcribing, not one, you know, handily labeled for them. And then they had to work through the handwriting. It was a good thing it was a 3-hour class, because I would say for the first hour, several of them just felt like they couldn't get anywhere. We ended up working in twos, and we used a big screen to sort of enlarge passages that we had trouble with, and people had their own laptops open, and then somebody would transcribe and somebody would dictate. The first hour or so, I think they thought it was probably my worst idea ever.
because they couldn't read it.
Yeah, well, because they weren't getting instant results. Because it took some time to sort of parse through. Is that a T or an S? I think it's a T. Look here, there's definitely a T there, and that looks the same. Okay, yeah, that's T. All right, so whenever we see that, that's T. There's a lot of that putting together. A decoding process, I would say. And it didn't yield instant results. And so there was some frustration in those first few, I'd say the first hour or so. But then once they got over that threshold, it got exciting because, oh, wait a minute, we saw that letter before. It was an S last time. That makes it an S this time. Steward, they're trash-talking Steward. And that sort of excitement of discovery started to be infectious.
That's Chandra Manning, a history professor at Georgetown University. We're also speaking with eighth grade social studies teacher Sarah Jahant. Sarah, so this year you worked with your eighth grade students transcribing documents for this transcription program that Chandra mentioned. How did it go for your students, your eighth graders?
Well, I would reaffirm almost everything that Chandra has said, the frustration level. When they don't, it doesn't come to them easily. So, I mean, it was a great challenge, and I, too, did not anticipate the difficulty with the reading of cursive. And like she had said about, like, you know, the copperplate cursive, some of it is very flowery. And so there was an immediate negative reaction when I proposed those documents to our group. I followed really very similar to her protocol. I pre-selected and did my research and gathered ones that I thought my students as a collective group, we would be capable, you know, of reading the style and the content as well, because there's literally thousands. And we found ourselves once deep into a legal document, and the language was just a barrier all of its own. So once they wrestled understanding the cursive of that author, we got to words where context clues were not helping us. We did what Chandra had said, where we tried to identify, like, this one was a T clearly, so it's a T in this word as well. And so once we got to that point, then, okay, the context clues help put together the meaning of this author's sentence. And so that was one of those moments, like, it was always a really rewarding aha for us, where they were able to take pieces and clues and then find what that missing link word is.
Chandra, was there a moment when you felt like your students really began to enjoy the experience of reading these documents?
Oh, for sure. I can think of a couple of real standout moments. One was in the Letters to Lincoln collection. They came across one from a young man who was studying law, and these are college students, some of whom, of course, they're Georgetown students, so you have a pretty safe bet some of them are thinking about law school. And so there was a letter from a young man about their age, wanting to study law, and he wrote to Lincoln to say, I'm sure you won't mind if I name you as a reference since you know my parents. And they just found this hilarious because it took
it he's like a normal person.
Exactly. It shrunk the distance between, that happened to be an 1858, I think, letter, but it shrunk the distance between 1858 and today, and it shrunk the distance between President Lincoln and a human being in the 19th century with friends and a career and very ordinary concerns. So a certain intimacy with the past emerged from that particular experience. And then another example of a certain intimacy being conveyed to them and teaching them something they couldn't have seen another way came through Clara Barton's diary. The Clara Barton papers are another collection that the Library of Congress is having crowdsourced like this. And my Civil War class spent some time with the Clara Barton diary. And that group did okay with cursive, actually. The cursive wasn't a barrier for one of them because she had learned cursive in school. So they got into content a little faster than some of the others. And they were struck by this episode where Clara Barton gets a fishbone in her throat. And she's sick with it for 3 weeks. And so they read 3 weeks of her diary, all during which she just isn't feeling well because of this fishbone. And that made a point to them, or made them see something that they hadn't before. And they could tell she wasn't feeling well because her handwriting got really spidery. It just, you could tell by looking at the actual formation of the letters that she was weak and she wasn't up to herself. And that made them realize, holy cow, here are people going through this enormous historical drama And ill health is everywhere. Like, how do you feel when you have to take an exam and you have a cold? You feel miserable. Here are people going through this in this cataclysmic experience, and nobody ever feels good. And that just totally changed how they thought about the war. And it drew them, it made them feel a certain connection to people living through the war as people and not just as sort of vagaries. And they were drawn to it partly by looking at that cursive, by looking at her handwriting and seeing it waver when she didn't feel well. So that was an exciting moment.
I want to ask both of you, and just end by asking both of you, teach history, if you worry about this being lost, Chandra, these moments being lost with your students if they can't read cursive.
Yeah, there is conversation about that exact question. And I'm not sure what to say. I think it will be harder than it has been in the past, and there will be a certain learning curve. But, you know, students figure out how to read Spanish and how to read German and how to read Sanskrit. So I think at the university level that it will be a hurdle, but one that can be surmounted. I'd really like to hear what Sarah has to say, though, because that's where it seems to be really concerning to me, is what about at the grade school level? You know, what about the level of kids who maybe have other interests besides history and aren't as motivated to get at these documents as, say, a history major would be? Does the cursive gap start to put history out of reach for grade school kids? I'd love to hear what Sarah thought about that.
Sarah?
Well, your point that you just made, Chandra, about the motivation factor, it hits it on the nail. Because without having it incorporated daily, which I'll talk about my district's future plans here to implement cursive, but without having like a plan to have it implemented and practiced and modeled daily, my concern is that it will gradually become something more for a more elite group that is focused and more academic. And like you had said, you know, at the college level, people will work through it, which I agree with entirely. But to be at the college level, like you are at a more, I guess, focused, more dedicated, more motivated effort to put into that interpretation. Whereas if you bring it down to my 8th grade level, my students, when I let them independently choose their document, 15 out of my 16, it was a very small group, 15 of them hands down requested, I want print. I want a newspaper, or I want something that's in print. I only had one student, and he exclusively said, give me all the cursives. It's fine. He goes, I can figure it out. And I thought that was very telling. He was very motivated. He was comfortable with the challenge, and he had the patience. The majority of my students didn't, and they were just more comfortable going to something that was print. And it was more satisfying, you know, they whatever their cause or their motive. Unless something is done, I really am afraid that it's going to become something more for an exclusive group of historians or that type. Now, I will say for my school district, I had said at the beginning that we have been very hit or miss in our consistency. And so now I credit our curriculum instructor, Dr. Beth Wackerlin. She's worked with our Board of Education, and they have improved now a plan. We're starting with grade 2, with second grade, this coming school year, which would be this fall. There's going to be outlined expectations. There's books and materials that's going to be used. And so second through our 5th grade are going to have a structured program where the expectation is students will be using cursive unless they have an occupational therapy prescription. You know, otherwise, all students are going to be held to that. And so that's our 2nd through 5th. I teach 8th grade. How that affects me, I mean, I will have that eventually, you know, those students will be writing cursive, but teachers as well, we have to model it. And that, like I said, my handwriting is a hybrid of print cursive. So, I mean, I'm kind of excited our school is making an effort towards that, because otherwise I really do think cursive is going to fall by the wayside for the majority.
That's Sarah Jahant, who teaches 8th grade social studies at Northbrook School in Mendota, Illinois. It's about an hour south of Rockford. I want to thank her and Chandra Manning for being with us, a history professor at Georgetown University. It's an interesting thing that I think a lot of people haven't thought about, history and cursive and writing. Ladies, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for the chance to do so.
Yep. Thank you so much, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we've been speaking with librarians, authors, and bookstore owners from around Illinois about some of their favorite books for this summer. If you've missed our conversations about fiction or nonfiction from earlier this week, you can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, to see those conversations. We'll also be posting a complete list with all of the recommendations we've heard so far this week, so be sure to keep an eye out for that. Today, we're talking about great summer books for the kids and preteens in your life. Not only can reading keep kids entertained during the summer months, it can also keep their minds active and ready for the upcoming school year if you didn't have enough motivation to get the children in your life reading. Joining me in studio now is Mike Regala. He's the Children's Services Manager at Champaign Public Library. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you.
George Rischel is also on the line with us from Verdon, Illinois. It's about 30 minutes south of Springfield. He's the owner of the independent bookstore, The Sly Fox. And from the northern end of Illinois, we have Jason Smith, who is co-owner of The Book Table in Oak Park. George, Jason, thank you for being with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So I wonder, Mike, if I can just start by asking what it's like at the Champaign Public Library in the summer in terms of the volume of children that are coming into the library?
Well, as a building, we have a gate count of about 2,000 people a day. Every summer day is almost like Saturday. Busy all the time from the time we open up to the time we close. We have upwards of, at present, about 1,300 kids participating individually in a summer reading program. That'll increase as we proceed in the summer through August. Just excitement. We have a lot of programs going on every week. We have programs going on every weekday morning for different age children. So we keep busy.
Jason, what about you? Are there a lot more children coming into the book table in the summer?
Absolutely. It happens all summer long. There's sort of different waves. There's the immediate excitement of the end of the school year. There's assigned summer reading, and there's the kids that have things that are assigned for the following year that they get on top of. And there's sort of the pre-camp, the during-camp, and post-camp rushes.
George, same for you, I imagine?
Yes, it is.
So, well, let's get started with some of the picks that we have here. And you guys have done a great job of doing all ages. But, George, I wonder if I could start with you because you actually have, let's start with the youngest age. You have a recommendation for a picture book that you really like. Can you tell us about Llama Destroys the World?
Oh, yeah, that's a book by Jonathan Stutzman and illustrated by Heather Fox. It's a good book for reading to kids or for kids to read themselves. It's got very few words, but it's got a lot of nice illustrations and graphics. And the llama tends to destroy everything that comes in his path, and he finally destroys the world. But in the end, it comes out the other side, and everything's fine at the end. But it's not the Llama Llama Red Pajama series.
Yeah, it's a little darker. The llama, yeah. It's llama starts out by eating a pile of cake and then eventually creates a black hole. So that's great.
Yeah, I think it ends where he discovers there's a bunch of pie and he's about ready to dig into the pie. And you think, oh, my goodness, it's going to start all over again.
Jason, when you're thinking about picture books, do you have a suggestion for people who are looking for picture books? What kind of topics?
Sure. I have particular suggestions, if you want. We're a huge fan of Cinderella Liberator by Rebecca Solnit, who's most known for what she does with adults, especially the book Men Explain Things to Me. And what she's done is a retelling in a contemporary feminist way, the fairy tale of Cinderella. It uses Arthur Rackham illustrations, silhouette illustrations, so it has an old-timey feel, but the book itself is completely updated. For example, Cinderella ends up actually owning a business instead of deciding to marry the prince.
Okay, that's Cinderella Liberator by Rebecca Solnit, one of Jason's picks. We also just mentioned Llama Destroys the World by Jonathan Stutzman. Mike, I wonder if we can go to a little bit older readers and one of your recommendations, which is Zoe and Sassafras, Dragons and Marshmallows. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Zoe and Sassafras is a series by Asia Citro. Marion Lindsay is the illustrator. Zoe has discovered is attracting magical animals to her house, and they're injured. The interesting part about the books is that it's not just a book about fairy tales and that sort of thing. She uses experimentation and research and scientific method to figure out what's wrong with them.
Oh, Wow. How did she do that then?
She just researched. I mean, she's got her microscope. She's got her lab table. Her cat is her assistant. So in the first book, Dragons and Marshmallows, she discovers a dragon that is injured, and they go about trying to save it.
And so this is a 7-book series, right?
Right. Right around third, fourth grade reading level. But it's on the current Illinois Monarch Award, well, the Monarch Award nominee list for 2018-2019, which is an Illinois Reader's Choice Award by children. And there's an interesting book award called the Mighty Girl Book of the Year. It's a winner of that.
And what age would you say this is for?
10, 11, 12.
Okay, 10, 11, 12. Jason, you have I wonder if we can jump back down again to ages 6 to 9. You have a recommendation, Ada Twist and the Perilous Pants, and this is also a series, the Questioners books?
Yeah, this is the second book in the Questioners series. People may be more familiar with the picture book series that Andrea Beatty, with illustrations from David Roberts, came out. Rosie Revere, engineer, Ada Twist, scientist, Iggy Peck, architect, and those are picture books. So they're for the sort of 4 to 8 range. But these are now the second in the chapter book series, so for the 6 to 9. The first was Rosie Revere and the Raucous Riveters, and now we have Ada Twist and the Perilous Pants. So they're fiction, but just like the series that was just described, there's a ton of really good STEM content in it. It is real science, and it is a nice, diverse group of characters that are working on it. And it's a great series.
Okay. So when we're thinking, George, about middle grade, what recommendations do you have for middle grade readers?
Well, I came up with what I called a couple of beach reads and a couple of road trips.
Okay, so maybe let's start with the road trips.
Well, there's a book called Finding Orion by Jonathan David Anderson. He's also the author of Miss Bigby's Last Day, for those who may remember that book. And this is about a family that is kind of quirky, and the grandpa passes away, and they go on a road trip to the funeral, and the young boy learns all sorts of things about his quirky family that he never knew before. It's just a, you know, summertime vacations, road trips, beaches.
Yeah, it's a good book to give for. It's a good book to have for a road trip. It sounds like, right, George?
Yes, it is. And another one in that vein is a little bit different. It's called A Wolf Called Wander. It's about a young wolf that has to find a new home after the family's pack is destroyed by another wolf pack. And so it's a different kind of road trip, but it's the same kind of journey.
Yeah, so those two books are that George just mentioned are Finding Orion by John David Anderson and A Wolf Called Wander by Roseanne Perry. If you are not remembering these titles, do not worry. We'll have them up at our website at 21stshow.org. But on that wolf theme, Mike, you have Endling, and that's kind of I don't know if is wolf the right is Endling, is that about a wolf, or it's kind of like about a dog-like species?
It's a dog-like species called a Dairn. It's by Catherine Applegate, who is the Newbery-winning author of a book called The One and Only Ivan, which does a particularly good job of thoughts of animals and living through them. Bix is, as far as she knows, the last surviving member of her species, and it's about her quest to find out if there's anybody else still around, and she bands together with other animals and humans in this kind of alternative world.
And so, yeah, Mike, I wonder when you're thinking about these, if these are kind of great books for kids who are really into the fantasy genre, if kids are kind of the classics that everyone kind of knows about of Harry Potter, or if we're thinking along any of those lines of Tolkien or those sorts of things, do you think this is a genre that this is a book that folks, kids who like that genre will also like?
Well, of course, even like kids who like Redwall, which is an extensive series of, you know, of anthropomorphic animals.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can go to a little older readers. Jason, you have picks for kids who are in the ages of 10 to 14. Which ones do you want to talk about there in that category?
I guess we could start off with It's Trevor Noah, which is the kid version of Trevor Noah's autobiography. And I will admit that a lot of celebrity autobiographies out there are probably not worth the paper they're printed on, despite the fact that they happily pay my rent from month to month. But Trevor Noah's book was very different. It was a serious literary editor who worked with him, Chris Jackson, and it not only was a mega bestseller, but was also praised for its content about, you know, Trevor Noah growing up in Africa. And they did a really good job when they moved it to the kid level.
So this is not the adult. So I read the adult version. This is not that. Then, right,
it is
Jason?
Not that. There's been a very good trend in recent years of taking, you know, best-selling adult nonfiction and moving it to a kid-friendly level.
Okay. Well, I really enjoyed the adult version of that. I think it was, as you said, I read a lot of memoirs, and most of them are not that interesting, and I think this one is. So,
yeah.
So that's the...
Yeah, so you take even like something like I Am Malala, which they've now done in three different versions, the original adult one, the one for middle grade readers, and also a picture book series. So it's one of the trends that is going on.
Okay. And when you're thinking about other YA, George, this is not in that vein. This is a little bit different. Can you tell us about The Last Voyage of Poe Blythe?
Oh, this is a book by Ali Condie. You may remember her as the author of the Matched trilogy. I think it was Matched, Crossed, and something else. And this is kind of more of a fantasy type of version for her. It's about a young girl named Poe Blythe, a 17-year-old captain of the outpost's last mining ship, and it would be a good read for, I would say, high school students that are not real heavy readers.
Okay. We are almost out of time, so we're not going to be able to get to all of the suggestions that you guys have made, but we will have them all up online. Mike, I wonder if we can end with one last one on your list. That we, which one would do you want to mention here?
Well, I was told by your producer you're a particular fan of Octavia Spencer.
I am.
So she's one of the... few celebrities actually writes well for children. It's much, you know, and
I didn't even know that she wrote.
She has a series called Randy Rhodes Ninja Detective. This starts out in the book called The Case of the Time Capsule Bandit. It's a Randy is a 12-year-old girl who has to move from Brooklyn, New York, to Deer Creek, Tennessee, after the death of her mother. And Deer Creek is about to have a Founders Day celebration, so it's going to, you know, put it back on the map. And somebody stole the time capsule. So it's up to her and her friends that she meets in that town to figure out the mystery.
Oh, well, now we know Octavia Spencer writes children's books. Okay, that's Randy Rhodes, Ninja Detective. So as I mentioned, everyone, George, Mike, and Jason have picked a whole bunch of these that we didn't get to all of them, but we're going to have all of them up at our website. Mike Regala is the Children's Services Manager at Champaign Public Library. I want to thank George Rischel, the Sly Fox. He's the owner of the Sly Fox in Verdon, Illinois, and Jason Smith, co-owner of the Book Table in Oak Park. Mike, George, Jason, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All the time we have for today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also find us on Facebook if you want to message us there, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. We'd love to hear from you about the show and hear your feedback. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or find our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21STShow.org. That's also where we have all of our past shows, and you can find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST, the 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.